Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, I'm going to tell you a funny story before I talk about who I want to speak about today. My good friend Ari Elbaum told me the other day that he went to the supermarket here, Semmel Market, the kosher supermarket, and he ran into our famous Baltimore kosher baker, Mr. Rosendorf. And he said something like, I have something I want you to give to Rabbi Katz. And he went and brought it and gave it to him. And it turned out that I mentioned a month or 2 months ago about a book that I had that I lent out to somebody about Gershon Kitover. And I said, truthfully, that, you know, I lend it, I don't know who it is, I'll probably never see it again. And Mr. Rosendorf was nice enough to order it online and get me a copy, and that's what he gave to Ari to give to me. This all happened on Friday. So I was joking about it. I said, wow, that's really impressive, which it is. And I said, you know, I have to do this more often. Maybe I can recover some of my books. Or, alternatively, maybe I can get some books that I can't afford. For example, I said, there's this new thing out that came out not long ago called Protocols of Justice, the Pinkas of the Metz Rabbinate Court, or something like that, 1771, 1789, in which a historian actually dug up the and published, it's a major work of scholarship, the Beis Din records of the Chagas Ari when he was a rabbi in Metz in the 1770s and 1780s. It's like amazing, two volumes. But I looked, and I really wanted to get it, and I looked it up online, it's like $300. I can't afford that. And so I said, I'm just going to tell next week that it's the Chagas Ari's yard site and see if we have any luck. Well, next day I come to shul, and the gabbai announces, guess what, this week is the yard site of Chagas Ari. Oh my goodness, I almost fell off my chair. I said, you've got to be kidding. And being superstitious, I take this as an omen. And therefore, I'm going to devote today's talk, yard site talk, to the famous figure of the Chagas Ari. Aside from that, I personally happen to have a connection, or let's say, I always felt fond of, or I always liked to say for Chagas Ari, for a long time for various reasons. And now I'm in the rabbi business. The Sefer, which came out in 1750, became very famous, as I'll try to explain later, and became used by rabbis of the old school, back in the old days, as your Shabbos HaGadol Drasha and your Shabbos Shiva Drasha, because the Chagas Ari is organized thematically, and it's mostly have to do with the Yamim Tovim, and it's perfect for Shabbos HaGadol, because he's got all this stuff on Chametz and Matzah, you know, all the sugyas and Pesachim, and it's good for the other one, Shabbos Shiva, because he has stuff on Yuma, and Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, and so it became a standby, and me, myself, and I do it also. What I do in my shul is, on Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Shiva, I give regular speech in the morning, for regular people, but then in the afternoon, you know, whoever wants to come. So we do 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours. my show's full of crazy people. And we always built something around the Chagas Ari, you know, old-fashioned type of speech. In the old country, you know, a Shabbos HaGadol speech and Shabbos Shuvah was not meant to be understood by anybody. It's supposed to go over their heads, except for a few lumdim, and then everybody would say, oh, wow, the rabbi spoke so fantastically, I did not understand a single word. Now, in America, this wouldn't exactly fly. But in Europe, in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, the people consider that Kavod HaTorah, you know, this. It's so sublime, I didn't understand a single word he said. Okay, so let's get down to actually what am I speaking about. The Chagas Ari is the name of a famous sefer written by a famous rabbi in the 1700s who lived in Eastern Europe at the end of his life in Western Europe. That's the long and the short of it. I'm going to do something interesting, I think unusual, maybe unprecedented today, and try to deal and give you in these short podcast a factual, the best I can, a factual description biography of this famous rabbi. The reason I say it is he became so famous that an entire universe of legends, lies, fables, baloney stories have been woven around him, and they're so well known that everybody takes it as the gospel truth. I don't know many Rabbonim and many Gedolim who have so many Bubba Mises said about them as the Chagas Ari, including his name, his birth date, his fights. I mean, it's amazing. It's one untruth after another. So I could devote a very interesting podcast called Bubba Meisters about the Shagasai, and you would love it. But you don't need me for that. You can go online. I'm sure there are a million of those. The Art Scroll published a kiddie book like that. The there's a lot of famous Meiselach, you know, the books that fell on him and killed him, and all kind of bull stories. But I'm going to try to do something a little bit different, based as best as I can, as best as I know, on the interesting recent scholarship that has been carried out in connection with this great person, shoving away a lot of mythology and trying to replace it with facticity. So here I go. Shagazai is a guy named Aryeh Leibn Usher. Rabbi Aryeh Leibn Usher. That doesn't mean anything. They say his name was Ginsburg. That's not true. So Aryeh Leibn Usher, who lived in the 1700s. If you want exactly 1710 to 1785. They give you different dates, but the dates are wrong. 1710, 1785. So he lived to be 75 years old. Now, who is this? It's from Minsk. Okay? Minsk is what you call Belarus. Today it's a separate country, Belarus. At that time, it used to be part of the Kingdom of Poland, which included Lithuania. So Lithuania, in the greater sense, Litvisha, meant the country of Lithuania today, plus Latvia, plus Belarus. That's what Litvak means. If you're from Belarus, or from Lithuania, or from Latvia, that makes you a Litvak, okay? Now, he comes from that kind of background, and from Minsk. Minsk is like the capital of Belarus today. And I would say in those years, for quite a long time, Minsk was, and the two Iker Litvisha cities, with the centers of culture and learning and all that sort of thing, and relatively large population, was Vilna and Minsk. That's who they were. And so they had famous rabbonim, schools, yeshivas, not one yeshiva, many, over the course of centuries. And being that it's an old, pre-modern Jewish community, plenty of fights, machloikas, and all that sort of thing that we associate with Judaism. Okay? Yeah, that's who we are. B'nai Korach L'meisu. Now, this person, Aryeh Leibn Usher, try to hold cup with the dates here a little bit. He was born in 1710. Obviously, from early baby on, he's a genius, you know, from young age, like a Mozart. And they say by the time he died, he made a Siyum HaShas number 1000. Siyum HaShas number 1000. Now, I don't know if that's true. Like I said, there's a lot of exaggerated Bava Mises. But I'm going to tell you something. It might be. You don't hear about anybody else. And, even the ones who don't hold from this all said he used to finish shots every year. So, that kind of thing. Now, therefore, this is old school Gaonim of a high order in which, they memorized and knew total command everything. Bavli, Yerushalmi, Sifra, Sifri, and et cetera, et cetera. Rishonim. Although, I want to point out something. Books of Rishonim and certainly Achronim were not so common in those days, especially in Eastern Europe, Eastern Poland. And I think, I could be wrong about this, I don't think the Shagazari had a Shittim of Gubetzes, you know what I'm saying? I don't think he had access to a lot of Rishonim, he had some. And so he will be the outstanding example, I would say, of a certain type of Gadol who basically, learns everything out of a few books and does the rest on his own brain work, as opposed to those kind of big rabbis who had big libraries and therefore had great erudition and knew a lot of ideas and sfaris, whatever, from a whole host of different sfarim. I get the impression, and so do most, that when the Shagasari, he had a Gemaras and all that, and he, of course, he had a Rambam, a Torah, and a Shulchan Aruch, and a couple of basic Rishonim, like the Rosh, you can see, and the Rif, and, the Ron, that kind of thing. And that's it, that's it. So you have a Rambam set, and you own a Torah set, and you own a Shulchan Aruch set, and he didn't hold so much from the Shulchan Aruch. One thing you're going to see about the Shagasai, which is famous, again, it's exaggerated, but there is something to it. He was the type of person, when he grew up, what's the right word? Say I had a big mouth. That's not the right word. But he didn't mind, shooting down even the biggest Rishonim and Achronim, saying they're wrong here. They know what they're talking about over here. The books we have today from him are censored. You don't have the original. Some famous Lithuanian rabbi, before they let it be published, cut out a lot of the objection material. Kind of thing you'd have on a blog today. You know what I mean? Anyway, he grows up to be this big super Eloi. Learning 24/7, and that's not much of an exaggeration. It's probably 22/7. And He's in Minsk. And so already at the age of 20, in his 20s, that would put us in the 1730s. Remember, he dies in 1785. So in the 1730s, he was taken to be a Rosh Yeshiva in Minsk. Now, I don't know whether there's one yeshiva in town. A town like Minsk probably had 5-10 yeshivas. But it seems to be the central yeshiva over there. Why not? He's young. He's brilliant. He's got it. He must have been very charismatic. Go ahead. Now, the rabbi of the city, who was also a Rosh Yeshiva, was the famous Yechiel Halpern, who wrote the Seder Adoros, who was, by my calculations, 50 years older. So you can already see the situation. You have a yeshiva with a famous old Rav, who's like, 1660? He's 80. Okay, he's 80. Or 70, rather. He's in his 70s. And now there's this new guy in his 20s. And the new guy's a genius. And you know what happens. Naturally, the students form into different factions, and it turned into a fight. Now, there are legends about the fight. And, you know, I don't want to go into the legends. It's famous, you know, that the Shagazari insulted the other one, and therefore the town threw him out on a garbage truck, on a Friday afternoon, and dumped him outside of town with no food. I mean, I'm not going to go into that, because I honestly don't think that stories are accurate. There might be, but best that I can tell, as they say, going through the best research that I know of, I don't think they're accurate. They're cool. They're nice stories, but they're not true. So here is somebody who is learning up a storm. And the interesting part from the intellectual point of view, as far as I'm concerned, is that because he had such an unusual breath, because he was a natural Eloy and photographic, and anyway, he's not even photographic. He's constantly chazzering over the Gan Shas all the time. And Alder has shown him, and the Shulchan Aruch, and the Poskim, and all that sort of thing. And Kabbalah, by the way, he knew the Kabbalah very well. So, because he's got all that under control in his mind, so he begins somewhere along the line to change his style of giving shir. And the Shagasai represents a leading figure in the 18th century and when the learning started to change. Let me explain what I mean. The old-fashioned way, the style that was considered cool in the yeshiva world, was the pulpal of the late Middle Ages. I've talked about it on podcasts before, at least I think I have. Maybe getting you confused with some class I gave, but I think so. And that was extremely localized. So basically, two chavrus is supposed to learn a Gemara. Don't look at Rashi, don't look at Tosis. After you figure out to your best satisfaction what the Gemara means, now see what Rashi says. And if Rashi says the same thing, then you know you've got trouble, because Rashi not supposed to say anything you can figure out on your own. And therefore, according to this way of thinking, and therefore, there must be something you missed. Because if you were Muhammad Rashi, it's a big problem. Today, we say the opposite. A guy learns a Gemara, he looks at Rashi, says the same thing. Wow, I was Muhammad Rashi, it's great. But in the old days, who do you think you are, you idiot? You think you're Muhammad Rashi? Rashi must be thinking of something else to bavorn what you said. And you end up with that way of thinking, and then you transfer that line of reasoning to Tosfos. You know, so you say, Tosfos asked Akasha and Rashi. What, Rashi, a dummy, didn't know Tosfos' answer? And you go back and forth and forth and back, and you're supposed to say on the daf. There's a lot of scholarship on this particular subject. And as we can tell, the result is you can give these really fancy, especially if you're a genius, you give these really fancy shiurim in the yeshiva and impress everybody, even though a lot of it's conjectural, especially when you reach the point of implicit readings, not what's explicit, but what's implicit. And the way I understand it is that he excelled in this, but over the course of time, since he knows everything, so he moves beyond it. And others gave the Pilpa Shirim along those lines, but somewhere along the line, this person, Ar-Yulei Ben Usher, is transcending to a next level, shall we say, in which you become more like a Rishon, in which you deal with what it says over here in the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, but you compare it to other places and other Rishonim, and even, you know, people like in the Tur and all that, you know, in Beis Yosef and the Bach, and basically, you kind of restore the Rishonic enterprise in which you compare the whole Talmud back and forth, including the Yerushalmi, everything else, one part to the other. And you end up with a much more satisfactory kind of shot in the Gemara and conclusion about what the Talmudic discussion is saying. That seems to be what happens. And by the way, you still use the tools of Pilpul. In other words, you compare and contrast, it's dialectical. You're also interested in the implications, not only the explicit, conclusions, but the implicit ones. So it takes the best of the old, but it leaves out the worst of the old and introduces a much broader spectrum. Now, he's not the only one that did it. This seems to be part of what thoughtful historians of rabbinical literature are now calling the intellectual revolution of the 18th century. I remember Professor Toshma, before he died, wrote an article about the Shagasari and the Pnei Yeshua in that context, because the Pnei Yeshua was also a little bit like that. Not exactly, but a little bit like that. Pnei Yeshua wrote in the sense of on the daf, you know, whereas the Shagasari, the Sefer Shagasari, is not organized that way. It's organized more in a thematic way, shall we say. But the idea of crossing everything all across Shas and all across Rishonim, and, you know, this Ritva here and that Rajba there and that Ron in the third place, all those are part of the same enterprise. So this is who he was. Now, he does that in his 20s and in his 30s and into his 40s. Around the age of 40 or so, which would put him in 1750, about, as best as I can tell, 1751, he leaves Minsk, not under dramatic circumstances, but it seems his father, Rav Asher, he's the son of Aryeh Leben Asher, his father was the chief rabbi of the province of Minsk, not the city of Minsk. The city and the province are two separate jurisdictions. They're always fighting throughout Jewish history. The big city in the area and the rest of the communities in the area, because the big city's full of these rich guys who want to subject the smaller communities in the district to their control so they can get a hold of the tax money. Jewish life has its underside, shall we say. And the way it usually worked out was you have two kehillas, you know, Lemberg and the Medina of Lemberg, Minsk and the Medina of Minsk, Vilna and the Medina of Vilna, and two separate chief rabbis, two separate basins, and the whole nine yards. So his father was the Rav, chief rabbi of the Medina, the Glil of Minsk, and he got old. It's the father, and the son left the Rosh Hashiva position to go help the father become sort of a system as running the show. It probably had 50, 60 communities under his jurisdiction. I would suspect that he figured like this: Yikrevu Yimei Evel Avi, when the father goes, I'll get his job. And he would have been totally happy, as far as I can tell, in that kind of environment. They had plenty of learners over there, people for him to talk to learn with, to hawk, and it would have been fun. So that would put you in the 1750s. Hold that thought. I think when it became clear that he's not going to get the job, someone else is going to get the job. So he left there and he went to, he looked for a shteller, as we would say today, a town. And he got a small village, small town called Volozhin. Maybe you've heard of it. And he became the rabbi there in the 1750s, in the early 1760s. The reason I say that is, again, keep this in mind. In 1765, he becomes the rabbi of Metz. So everything is built around that date. So for 15 years or 14 years or 13 years, he's the rabbi of the small town of Volozhin. It's as best as we can tell, he took a couple of really hot students. And he had like a kibbutz, which in the old sense means you get a couple of really good guys. And they learn together. They don't necessarily have to be married, but they learn together intensively. And he's giving what we would call today high-level shiurim. What do I mean when I say high-level shiurim? It's a kind of rejection of the old pilpul that I described before, the very localized one that had been popular for so many centuries. It's the beginning of what you call, it's the beginning of, as far as I can see, of this Litvisha attitude that we're doing something new, fresh, and a new way of doing learning over here. And it's only for we few, we chosen few, you understand? And he indeed did it. So the new way of learning that he came up with, evolved, is what you see in his book. Because while he was the rabbi in Volozhin, so he obviously wanted to publish a lot of his shiurim and conclusions. And you must have thought that there have something to contribute, you know, it'd be something different, and it certainly were. And when he was at that time in 1750s in Lithuania and in White Russia, believe it or not, there was no printing press for a whole bunch of reasons. And so if you want to get a book published, you had to take it to Germany, which is next door to Poland. And so he traveled to Frankfurt, the Oder, not Frankfurt, the main. There are two Frankfurts in Germany. I know you don't know this, but there's one in West Germany and one in East Germany. The one with Samson Raphael Hirschel in West Germany, I'm talking about the Frankfurt in East Germany, called Frankfurt on the Oder River. And he published it in 1756, I believe, and it made a huge splash, okay? This is Sefer, which he called Shagasari. So he's Aryeh Leben Asher, he called Shagasari. Anybody who's all familiar with this Sefer knows it's written in an unusual way. It's in the form of response to shalos and tshuvos, but not really. It's not like somebody asked him a question. That's not the literary form that it's presented in. But rather, you present a theoretical question. You understand? A theoretical question, which then forms the basis for a broad shiur. Do you put on tefillin before tzitzis? That's the shaila, correct? Things like that. Is kiddush have to be on wine? They're theoretical. They're not theoretical exactly, but they are questions that deal with concepts. Let's put it that way. The literary style was different than any other sefer before that I can think of. It kind of reminds you a little bit of the Trumas Hadeshen, and each one is not treated as a regular responsum, but it's the subject of an intellectual discussion. The Gemara says this, you have this region's opinion here, you have a kasha from elsewhere, until he finally comes to his conclusion. So the question and answer format serves as the basis for Hill's learned discussion, shall we say. And meanwhile, it takes you up and down all through the sugyas, it's very straightforward. There's nothing around about. He's got a raya from a Beferish Tosfos or something like that, or at least the implications of one. He has a raya or a kasha from a Rambam. He has something from a Gemara. This becomes his classic style. And even writes in the Hagdam, I remember, he said, I used to give old-fashioned pilpul shurim, kol ze yisa ruach, or something like that. So it was all baloney. That was all the learning I did before of that style. Was there for shtick? But what I'm sharing with you now is what I've come up with, probably from Balazhin, from the Minskiers, my good stuff. You know what I'm saying? This is the good stuff I worked out with my students over here. And so just imagine this, my friends. Here you are in a stupid little town like Balazhin. I was there a couple years ago. It's a little village, and became famous, of course, but in his time, it was one of many, many little places. Ain't nothing to do in those places. No strip mall, no movies, no TV, no nothing. So if you're built that way, you can learn, and when I say learn, the Chaim Brisker style, the Shagasa, you put out a kasha there, and you think, you talk with the students, they think some more, you ask, you analyze, you reanalyze, you're malabain, as the expression goes. And therefore, you come up with better material, shall we say. Your conclusions and your svaras come out better. And that's what he put into this sefer, which indeed, as I said before, was not like other svarim of the 18th century, and therefore made a big impact. Sorry about that. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So he was a rabbi in Volozhin, and there's a famous Yeridea thing involved. It's too complicated to explain to you all. And his fame must have resounded as a result of this. And consequently, he got an offer from a big community that actually paid a real salary when he was a Volozhin. At least the stories they say, is that he had a very small salary and was poor and starving and that sort of thing. There used to be an old joke, a bitter joke in Europe. It's a good thing the rabbi fasts on Monday and Thursdays. Otherwise, he starved to death. So I'm sorry, he was maybe from that school. Now, I'm sure somebody like him probably forgot to eat. He's the type that learns all day long. But he's got a wife, he had children, Now, I'll tell you something interesting. He was there in approximately 1751 to 1764, about those years. Who was growing up at that time? Chaim Balushner and his brother. Chaim Balushner was born in 1749. See, that's why I make a deal about the dates. It actually kind of matters because there are a lot of false stories told about the Shagasai. You can simply tell the dates are off. So Chaim Balushner, who was the son of the richest guy in town, I believe, grew up in this little town of a little village of Balushin, and 1749. So he was 2-3 years old when the Shagasai became the rabbi there. And he was about 13 years old or 14 years old, when he left. So keep that in mind, because later in life he said, I learned by the Shagasari. Yeah, he did, but in those years, very young years. One of the reasons of Chaim Balushin, one of the reasons is very famous, is because he was a Talmud, number one of the Shagasari, number two in the Vilna Gaon. Can't get better than that. And he himself was a genius, so, we put all that together. But those are the years that the Shagasari was there. There are stories about them, but I'm not sure. I don't think that they're true. Okay, so here's a guy who's a big Talmud Chacham, and it's actually in a small village. Eastern Europe had a lot of those because of oversupply and demand. There were more Gaonim than Shtellers. By that I mean there were more geniuses than large communities where genius would find wide room for, teaching and poskening and all that. I'm telling you something interesting. There are a lot of famous rabbis in Jewish history, big Talmid Chachamim, and they never got a position equal to their abilities. To use American terminology, it's not the same thing, American terminology. There's guys who could be rabbis of shuls of 500 families, and they'll only be shuls of 10 families. You know, it's like that. So because of that, so there was actually a dearth of, big kehillas. And as you might imagine, most of them were politics and wrapped up with the Old Boy Network and that sort of thing. But still, I would say there were about a dozen or maybe 15 large and important kehillas, maybe a little more, in the 18th century. That's not so many. You know, if you tell me Frankfurt and Prague and Krakow and Lemberg and Vilna, not so many, you see. A couple others, obviously Hamburg, there were, Amsterdam, but there aren't as many as you would imagine. So that's why somebody like Shagasari, even especially after he became famous through publishing his scholarship, where do you go? Now, he got very lucky, because one of the A-level communities hired him sight unseen, based on his scholarship. And that was Metz, which is in France now, and was in France then, which is a very interesting story because it's all the way to the other side of Europe. Most of you have no idea geography, so you probably have no idea what I'm talking about, but go look at a map. And you'll see that Metz is in what we call Alsace-Lorraine. Metz is the capital of Lorraine, which is part of something called the Kingdom of France, wherein lies a tale because France is a country which expelled all the Jews back in the 1300s. Spain did it in 1492, but the French did it before. Very anti-Semitic country. And so for the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 1700s, no Jew was allowed to live in France. But then the following happened. The French kings, as part of their wars of conquest, moved east and took over eventually what's called Alsace and then Lorraine in the time of Louis XIV and Louis XV. And when they did that and annexed these territories to France, so they got a lot of territory, and they also got 50,000 Jews. Now, what do you do with them? So you might say, well, the French could have said, since we have a law, no Jews allowed, get the heck out of here. Leave the country. But that's not what they chose to do, even though the kings of France were pretty anti-Semitic, but they were practical. And it turned out that the economy of these provinces relied on the Jews to some degree, and the French army and civil administration relied on the Jews 95%. The Jews came from day one to be the ones that could efficiently supply the French military with horses, with food, with weapons even, and all kind of stuff like that. And turned out a very interesting situation. Because of this economic utility, even though the kings of France did not like the Jews, and the people of Alsace-Lorraine definitely hated the Jews, big anti-Semites, but nevertheless, it happened that the kings of France permitted Jewish communities in Alsace-Lorraine, which became a big center of Yiddishkeit, believe it or not. So I'm talking about an area which is in the extreme west of Germany, but now has been taken over by France, and has been part of France from that time till today, with the exception of a few years, Bismarck's time and all that. But generally speaking, these are Yiddish-speaking Yekis of a certain type. I'll say it again, Yekis of a certain type. And the Yiddish is a German Yiddish. This is before the Yekis started talking German, our ancestors, and they considered themselves part of the Ashkenazic world, so they had no problem in bringing in a Litvisha Rav, who speaks a different Yiddish, from the other side of Europe, to be the Rav there, because basically it's all the same. It's all the same Ashkenaz. That just tells you a lot. It's very interesting in this regard. And so, Rabbi Yehuda ben Usher became the rabbi in of the Kehillah, the Av Basin, and the Rosh Yeshiva of Metz to the end of his life for 20 years, from 1765 to 1785. In other words, from the time he was 55 to the time he was 75 when he died. Now, Metz was a Kehillah of about 3,500 Jews in the time of the Shagas Aryeh, and that was big by Jewish standards. Right? Today, it's the size of a neighborhood. But Vilna was no bigger. And so it was an important community because of their importance to the French economy. The Kehillah of Metz was, let's put it this way, the Kehillah was always in bad economic situation. I'm not going into that, but it had a bunch of rich Jews there. and they had rich Jews who were like court Jews. You know, they had the contracts with the government. They supplied the army and that sort of thing. There was a family bear, Serf Bear, and they bankrolled yeshiva and learning and that sort of thing. In other words, they had the old fashioned values in which they respected learning, and as a result, you could have all the way in France a big center of Torah and Yiddishkeit, and it was now presided over by one of the most famous rabbis of the 18th century, Shah Gasari. That was that book I told you, beginning Protocols of Justice, is all about that, and he was therefore the Rosh Yeshiva, charismatic Rosh Yeshiva, in the 1760s, 70s, and 80s in Metz, and also the head of the Beis Din, official chief rabbi of a community, our Beis Din, which means he played two roles. And this is where he spent the rest of his life. Okay. Now, there are some famous stories, which I think actually are true, and makes total sense, that, you know, he became the Rav there in 1765, and then 1766 was the first Shavuos, and he got to a fight with them because he said that they should do the Akdomas like most of us do today. Before, you call the guy up, and then you read Akdomas, and then he says, Baruch Hu Hashem Bavarach, and all that. And that way, there's no hefsik between the time you read Akdomas and the Brachas. But the Yekesh way, the old way, which goes back to Rashi's time, frankly, and the Akdomas was actually written not far from Metz, was that you call the guy up for Aliyah. They say, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem, we call him Nelson, and then you sing the Akdomas, and then you do the Laney, which he said, well, that's a hefsek. Now, you see, here you have a wonderful clash between Minhag and Halacha. The Shah Gasari, by this time of his life, if not all the time, was a total Gemara guy, meaning I learned the sugya myself, I know everything from top to bottom, I did all the relevant Rishonim, and now I reach my conclusion. And if I hear some minig along the way, it makes no sense. The minig is wrong. There are two different attitudes out there. This is fascinating. I could go on this for hours. There are two different attitudes out there, and always have been, always will be. One is, if a great rabbi said to do this, it must be that that's the way to go. It doesn't make any sense to me, but if you tell me Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said it, if you tell me Rabbi Chaim Meiser did this, if you tell me, you know, Ritzik Ohana did this, okay, even though it doesn't make any sense to me, but great people like that must know what they're doing. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, I don't care who said nothing. Let me do all the work. I'll go through all the Gemara, the Rishonim, the Achronim, and all business. I'll work out Svar Yishar the best I can, and then I'll call it like I see it. And if I become convinced that this Minug, which you tell me was put together by some great person, is wrong, call a spade, you know? It's wrong. Change it. And Shah Gasari is number two, you know, from that school. And he goes down in history. His fame is that he's an outstanding example of that, which is why he didn't hesitate. I remember he called the Rabbeinu Tam and said, you know, really messed up over here. And these other Achronim messed over there. He did because, you know, that was his teva, you understand? And I want you to know, there's a famous Chassam Sofer. Now, if anybody was a respecter of Minhagim, it's the Chassam Sofer. And the Chassam Sofer, when he was young, I think met the Shah Gasari, I believe, when he passed through Frankfurt in Western Germany. Metz is not that far from Frankfurt. Anyway, the Chassam Sofer said like this, if you are like the Shah Gasari, and you do the Shas between Yom Kippur and Yom Kippur and Rosh Chodesh El, and then from Rosh Chodesh El till Yom Kippur, you do all the Kabbalah, you know, the Zohar, Kisei Arizal, and all that stuff, then you have the right to argue with Tosis because you are a Baal Tosis. But until then, shut up. So Shah Gasari can do it, but you can't do it, I can't do it. Which I get, you know. So he became, as I say, the big halakhic authority in that part of the world. And he engaged in the famous controversies of the 1760s and 70s, most famously the Get of Cleves, which is now not a time to go into that. And that was like he spent the rest of his life. We actually found, and I remember a historian, Schwartz-Fuchs, published the contract, you know, the community negotiated with him with the salary. I don't remember the salary anymore, but I do remember one of two things. One is that they'll pay for 25 students. You know, this is the old Av Bezin days in which a Rav is expected to run a yeshiva. That's where you spend most of your time. What do you give speeches? They don't do that junk. So you don't visit, you know, the hospital, all that. That's for the modern American Orthodox Protestant rabbi. In the old days, Rav was supposed to sit, learn and teach Talmidim who'll be his, the next generation. And the question is, how much will the community kick in? You know, how much will they cough up? And they'll pay for, I remember, 25 students. You want to get more students? Because, hey, but you raise the money. We'll pay for 25 students. And I remember also they wrote in there something like, he can't give smicha unless the kehillah is okay, because it must have been a source of income issue or something like that. And there are other paragraphs, I don't remember them all. If you go online, you probably could find it, if you care. If you read French, I'm sure I remember seeing it in French once, online, long ago. So that was the story of Shagasari. That's when he published the Tori Evan, when those three Masechtas. And, that was like the end of his life. I would say this, that he made a tremendous impression on his students, and as you would imagine, and they're French, right? They're Ashkenazic Jews in Alsace-Lorraine. And they're the next generation of Jews in France. The Yad David, if you're familiar with that sefer, and people of that nature who had the misfortune of being rabbis and scholars in the French Revolution period and Napoleon period, the post-Napoleon period, when Yiddishkeit was under tremendous cultural attack. The influence of the Shagasari remained there. The old-timers could remember him. And that's why they stayed from for quite a long time. It was like the next generation after that, the Yiddishkeit started to crash in France. And even when it crashed in France, they never quite went reform. They just went screwed up Orthodox. Even to this day, the Consistoire, the French official, denomination, is officially Orthodox, even though I think some have organs and things of that nature. Believe it or not. And in general, Yiddishkeit in France has moved back to the right since the Sephardim moved there, in the 50s. So although I haven't been in France, but I am hoping to go next year. A lot of this has to do, I'm talking about the Ashkenaz now, the influence of the memory of the Shagasari was there for a very long time. On a personal note, I myself, how should I put it? When I had bar mitzvah, I'm from the old school. My mitzvah was a million years ago. And the old TA, Rabbi Samson, who was the head of the school at that time, he himself was 100 years old at the time. He, when you had a bar mitzvah, at least when I was growing up, you had a bar mitzvah, you had a speech to give in Yiddish, a Dvar Torah, a Pshetel, and it was always from Shagasari, and there were like two or three famous ones. And mine was, Hezagadah, I don't have it anymore. And I remember he misspelled my name on purpose because he always had a fight with my father how to spell cats. Like, he knows how to spell cats better than we do. But that's the Mishigas of the old school. Anyway, it was a whole long thing in Yiddish. I had to memorize it. But those that you had to memorize, you can't read, And in front of all the Rabbi Rudim and this and the other, oh my goodness. So they didn't know anything about self-esteem in those days. Forget it, baby. But you had to, run the gauntlet and finish your shuttle. My youngest son, I remembered that, and I wrote it up in English for him, so it was easier. That's a new, nowadays we're more into, pampering the children, so he, read it. It's a famous, I'm sure some of you must be familiar with that from your own backgrounds. The Rambam on Tumah Dechui V'Tzibur, and, the Tzitz, whether it's Maratza, when the Kohen's wearing it or not, all those sorts of things of Hesach Hadas. But whatever the case is, it became a classic. That's what you used for bar mitzvah pshatel long ago. Why did Shagasari? It's very interesting. Somehow or other, this sefer caught the imagination of the public. I think because he was the real personification of the image that later is transferred to the Vilna Gaon. You're learning 24/7, mamish. And the Vilna Gaon stayed in one place his whole life, in Vilna. Shagasari moved from here, there. And he had a stronger, more, what's the right word? Cantankerous personality. The Vilna Gaon stayed in the Klais. He lived in Vilna all of his life, except for a short period. And he, had his own little Beis Medrash, shall we say, with select students. The Shagasari moved everywhere. He had bigger yeshivas. He was in towns. He engaged in politics much more. And yet, at the same time, finished his shas 1,000 times or something like that, as they say. Plus the Nigla, plus the Nister, and there are many legends about the Vilna Gaon meeting the Shagasari back and forth. I'm sure they met, but most of the legends don't work out if you know the years. There's similar things with the Baal Shem Tov. I don't know how the Baal Shem Tov could ever meet the Shagasari. Look, anything's possible, but the Baal Shem Tov lived in one end of Poland, the Shagasari lived in the other end. It's possible they met. There are cool stories, but I'm trying to avoid like I say, the Bubba Mice is today, even though they're very cool. The Bubba Mice are super cool, but I don't want to do that. That wouldn't be right. Instead, you have the image of somebody who comes across, you know, mythically, shall we say. When I say myth, I don't mean it's not true. I mean the, you select parts of the image to the neglect of the others as a person, as I said before, who's learning all the time, who believes that you have to work out all the sfaras on your own. The Shagasai emerges as the classic model, the person who doesn't have sfarim and therefore has to do it the hard way. You have to figure out the terutzim here and not go in cheater books and look, you know, in some other sefer to see if they have the answer. But you got to work it out yourself. You know, the constant chazara forever and therefore very independent attitude. I worked it all out myself and, you know, shared with my Talmidim. And you can be sure any ID came, he ran it by others and they attacked him and he had to defend it. You know, that's the world of what the Germans used to call the rabbinic matadors of yesteryear, in which, you know, you say as far, the other guy tries to slug it up, you defend it back and forth, forth and back. And a good time is had by all. And Kulo Torah, now the Shagasai is not associated with anything other than learning, you know, and that sort of business. You know, so it's not part of the politics of that generation. And what else? Like I say, totally prepared to take on any other svar that disagree with them, even from a Rishon. That doesn't bother him at all. Most rabbis aren't like this. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of different. As I said, I encountered this when I was a bar mitzvah. I did, but it didn't mean anything to me. You know, I knew the Shagas Aryeh and Hetzach Hadass and Shul, big deal. When I was older and went to yeshiva, I found something really cool because the Shagas Aryeh itself I found hard to read when I was young. And then I found a cheater book. When I was like 20, some guy in Israel, Yoshalmi, I think his name was, believe it or not, he put out something called, he didn't call it, this is the Shagas Aryeh cheater book, where he took all the sefer and he broke it up into little pieces and it's like a spoon feed and even had the Dibri Chacham Shenosu and Nosu B'Dibri Rabbeinu, something like that. You know, other Achronim that try to comment and argue with Shagas Aryeh, these literature abundant. I never heard about some guy in the, who's a rabbi in the unheard of little village here and, you know, in the 1920s, whatever. And I thought it was really cool. And I, for years ago, I mean, I'm talking many years ago. You know, I used to go through this. That's how I got familiar with the Shagas Aryeh, through the cheater book. And it's only later that I got into the regular sefer. And only in the last 15 years did they put out nice editions, or 20 years they put out nice editions with, you know, decent print and footnotes and all the rest of it. Recently, Rabbi Shaftel Neuberger told me there's some new guy that came out very recently with an edition of Shagas Aryeh. I saw it somewhere. I wasn't impressed. But on the other hand, by contrast, there was like a blue cover thing that I got about 2-3 years ago in Israel, I think, or wherever. Shagas Aryeh, with the Shagas Aryeh Chadoshos, with extra, you know, essays of his that were published long ago, and very good footnotes. Very, very fine footnotes indeed. And I just actually, I'll share with you something very briefly. I'm a Kohen, so therefore I'm interested in Kohen questions. And me and Steve Kaplan, we're both Kohanim, we were learning together Kohen stuff and came across the famous issue in Nazir about the Shita Zeravid. Some of you may know what I'm talking about, who says Kohanim are not Mitzvah Nafushi Tuma, which means, this may surprise some of you, that the Ravid says, or seems to say, that if you're a Kohen and you're Tamei, for whatever reason, for Tamei Mace, then you can become Tamei Sad. Then you don't have to worry about it ever again. You can go to funerals and all the rest of it. I'll give you an example. Take me, myself, and I. So, I'm Tamei. My father died. I went to the funeral, you know. No problem there. But I am Tamei. If you go like the Ravid, I could go to medical school. That's where it always pops up. Can a Kohen go to medical school? Because you got to deal with the dead bodies. So we say, well, if you're already Tommy, you're already Tommy, then it doesn't matter anymore. And for some reason in the 18th century, this was heavily debated. It's interesting to me. A lot of Kohan, you could write a book. Maybe I should. Kohanim in the 18th century. It's a whole parsha, like the tunnel under the ghetto with the Pnei Yeshua and all that. And Kohanim, just to give you an example, They say when Nelson Adler ran away from Frankfurt and he passed through Prague with his young buddy, the Chasam Sofer, who was a teenager, and he stayed by the Nodav Yehuda for a while, they were hacking the whole time in the question about the Sheets arrive at and the Fushi Tumay knows. Can a Kohen, you know, go to medical school, basically. And believe me, as a rabbi, you're always looking for heter if you can find one. And look, I didn't go to medical school, and nor did my kids, but I'm sure I've heard of some people who do, and I'm sure that's where they get the heter from. Now, therefore, when I learned Nazir, I said, you know, let's see how you can work it out according to the Ravid. And, you know, the Yetzer Hara always tells you to try to work it out the way you want it to work. Well, a couple years ago, I saw this new Shagas Aryeh, and it turns out in the Chadoshos, he has a whole discussion exactly on that sugya. And he goes through it from top to bottom, in and out. He leaves no stone unturned. He walks you through the Gemara, back and forth, in and out. And unfortunately, my friends, by the time he finished, he said the Ravid is wrong. We don't pasuk in this way. It's not the way the Gemara works out. He read it wrong. He said the Ravid, he read the Ravid wrong. And what he said makes sense. And so I said, Oive, there you go. But that's who the Shagas Aryeh is. You know, he is a supreme command of this business. I would make one more observation, even though I've gone over the time. He captured the imagination of a non-from world. That really surprises me. If you look in encyclopedia, the old Jewish encyclopedia, I remember years ago, to look at the article on Pilpul, was written by a former rabbi. He says, if you want to understand Pilpul, you have to read the Shagas Aryeh. And he gives you in English, in the old Jewish encyclopedia, in English, a couple of cases from the Shagas Aryeh. I couldn't believe it. You know, like, how do you know it? Maybe I came from an Orthodox background or something like that. There are other forms like that also. I mean, other English books like that also that will reference whenever they want to touch on Lamdas, touch on it, the stuff from the Shagas Aryeh. So he captured imagination in ways other people didn't. It's interesting. He's not the only great rabbi of the 18th century, but occupies a special place in the imagination. And as long as there are Shabbos HaGadol speeches, he will continue to do so. But what boy, have I gone way beyond my time, so I'll conclude with that.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.